concomitant threads of things we might like to explore. And this is a new thread that has the grandiose title Cultures of Mind Reading, the Novel and Other Minds. And it basically arose because I was reading or rereading various bits from the canon of the English novel, and I noticed that novels were interestingly plural in the way they talked about interactions between people. So you might have, like in Dickens's great Journey to Two Cities, the premise of the novel is partly that you don't know what someone is thinking. But even in a novel like that, there'll be moments when there's kind of spontaneous interaction with people, and people do know what the other person's thinking, or they spontaneously take their hand, as happens in a moving moment in Daniel Deronda and other texts. So it seemed to me that a novel didn't worry about the fact that essentially they were kind of had different competing ontologies, that that we were in touch with each other, or we were completely in a irrevocable distance from each other. And depending on what the plot needed or the situation needed, you could kind of swap in whatever ontology or theory of mind seemed useful. And I thought that this might then be an interesting thing to discover and to explore, because first of all, to see what the kind of the resource of the 19th century novel told us in relation to recent investigations in cognitive science about so-called social cognition. And I also thought it was a very good project for this comparative criticism thing, because if you want to make the case that social cognition, or the way how much we know or think we know about each other, is kind of culturally specific, then different traditions of novel writing would be quite a good place for testing the sorts of ways in which different cultures deal with how much we can know about each other. And so that's the bigger project, and this is the first seminar kind of investigating, I suppose, whether this is going to go anywhere as an idea. And I was absolutely delighted when then David Herman said yes to the invitation to be our first speaker. David is Professor of Engaged Humanities at the University of Durham, to which he's just moved, and he's author of a book that came out this year, Storytelling and Sciences of Mind, as well as a whole heap of other things. And he's recently, and very interestingly for the project that we're starting here, he's recently started to think about not just other human minds, but other animal states of mind, or whatever you want to call them, and that's partly what we're speaking about today. The format is that David will speak for about 35 minutes, and then we have two respondents, who I'm also very, very pleased to have on board. Emily Trashenko is a research fellow in modern languages at St. John's, and her book, Kafka's Cognitive Realism, which is kind of right in the heart of these debates about what cognitive sciences and the literary studies have to say to each other, will be appearing early next year with Routledge. And James Carney is a postdoctoral researcher at the Synergy, of course, itself, so Social Evolution and Neuroscience Research Group. So we've actually got someone who's coming over from a psychology lab to talk to us. He's the representative humanist in the lab. Is that one of your functions?
Yes.
Yeah.
He's done partly done work on Beckett, but then is now expanding into this area of empirical psychology and its interface with humanities. So the format will be David will speak for 35 minutes, and then we'll have a break for questions and clarification. But just for clarification, we'll save the kind of meaty questions for later, and then each of Emily and James will do their little piece, and again we have questions for clarification. And then we have traditionally have a pause where you can fill a glass with some wine or apple juice or water or whatever, and then we sit down and we kind of talk for as long as we want to. But if I can then vacate the floor for David to give his presentation.
Ben, just so we continue.
Oh, sorry, yes, thank you very much. Celine's reminding me that. So we record things, we put them up on the website, which is, and if you don't want to be recorded, that's fine, we need to know. But if you do want to, and then we will remove anything you say from our record, sort of Stalinist airbrush or whatever the equivalent is for audio recordings. But if you're fine being recorded, then please just put your name and signature on this piece of paper which is going around the room. We've all signed, so it's not dangerous. Anyway, so over to David. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you very much, Ben, and wanted to thank Ben and Celine and everybody responsible for organizing the session. It's a privilege to be here. Also wanted to thank James and Emily for agreeing to be respondents, and looking forward to the discussion all around. Some of the ideas I'm trying out here are sort of new, so I'm eager to get insights and comments. So I don't know if you can see this all right, but so my topic is narrative and as heterophenomenology, modeling non-human experiences in story worlds. And I'll come back to the and as part toward the end of the presentation. But just to give a thumbnail definition of the term heterophenomenology, which I'm borrowing from Daniel Dennett, which I'm going to modify as I proceed, I think we can basically define it as the ascription of subjective experiences to others. And I'm interested in that process of ascription when it comes to narratives that feature non-human others, non-human animals, and how that sort of works in that environment. So here's a synopsis, which is also on your handout. I'll start by talking about the transdisciplinary approach to narrative studies and the cognitive sciences that I try to develop in the 2013 book that Emily and James will be responding to, I believe. It's transdisciplinary because I'm trying to avoid any kind of one-way borrowing from the cognitive sciences into narrative studies, trying to set up a two-way dialogue that would involve some kind of reciprocal exchange. Then in the second part, I'll look at the emphasis within the study, the exploration of narrative world-making and thinking about how that plays out when there are non-human agents involved in narrative worlds. And then in the last part, I'll come to this question of heterophenomenology and think about directions for inquiry in terms of linking narratology and heterophenomenology. So, on to part one. Now, the book develops strategies for investigating what sorts of mental states, capacities, and dispositions may provide grounds for, or conversely be grounded in, narrative experiences. So I'm thinking both about stories as a target of interpretation and what kinds of mental capabilities, dispositions you need to make sense of stories. Also, how stories themselves enable ways of relating to the world, support efforts to understand the world, and afford certain kinds of capacities and dispositions. And as already mentioned, I'm trying to develop dialogue between the study of storytelling across media and inquiry into the scope and nature of intelligent behavior. So I'm really making two cross-cutting distinctions. First, between studying narrative as a target of interpretation and studying narrative as a resource for sense-making or an instrument of mind. And then also leveraging the sciences of mind to investigate stories, but also drawing on ideas developed by narrative scholars to think about focal issues in cognitive science. And you can permute these different variables to produce different approaches, as indicated on the slide there. So, for example, you can take a cognitive science approach to questions of narrative interpretation, but you can also flip things around and look at how narrative scholarship might bear on understandings of discourse comprehension, theories of narrative understanding as developed in cognitive science, and so forth. And again, the overall goal is to develop a transdisciplinary approach that avoids any one-way importation of cognitive science work into scholarship on narrative. And in fact, my argument is that the mind-narrative relationship cannot be exhaustively characterized by the arts and humanities, by the social sciences, or by the natural sciences taken alone. So genuine dialogue and exchange across these fields of endeavor, rather than some particular field, which then becomes dominant, providing the way for all the other fields, will be necessary if we're going to come to terms with this connection between narrative and mind. Throughout the book, my goal is to keep the target phenomena, how the interpretation of stories yields narrative experiences, how stories allow people to interpret experience itself, keep these target phenomena at the center of analytic attention, drawing on various disciplinary frameworks when they become relevant to the issues under discussion. In this way, instead of there being any subordination of humanistic vocabularies and methods to those of the social or natural sciences, or vice versa, in a transdisciplinary approach, different investigative modes and traditions can converge on various dimensions of the problems at hand. In short, my argument is that theorists of narrative have something to contribute to as well as learn from debates concerning intelligent activity. So this brings us to part two. Narrative world-making and non-human worlds. So, to reiterate, I'm focusing in the book on two aspects of engaging with world with narratives. On the one hand, narrative viewed as a target of interpretation, which I call worlding the story. On the other hand, narrative viewed as an instrument of mind or resource for interpretation, which I call storying the world, using narratives to interpret or construe the world. And when it comes to that first dimension, worlding the story, this process entails using textual designs and narratives as affordances for narrative world-making. And these affordances will vary depending on the storytelling medium involved, whether it's print texts, media that combine words and images, and so forth. This part of the study focuses on topics like what sorts of constraints and affordances do go along with different media, and for that matter, with different narrative genres. how do non-fictional versus fictional narratives, what sorts of protocols for rulemaking are entailed by those two types of narrative. I also think about perspective taking in narrative worlds, what sorts of perspective indexing cues are available in a given medium, and how does that shape our encounter with the world evoked by the story. And then also characters, categorization, and the concept of person. So in some cases, we can work in a top-down way from existing models of persons that we derive from everyday encounters, from social discourses, from literary types like the braggart or the selfless hero. And then we can kind of map those models onto the characters we encounter. Other characters, though, are more sui generis or atypical, and they don't assimilate readily to those kinds of models, so they necessitate that we build or reinflect our available models and change them. So Hamlet, being a case in point, or some of Juno Barnes's characters might, let's say, necessitate new kinds of models or adjustments to old models. And more generally, making sense of stories in the sense of worlding the story entails using textual designs to explore dimensions of mentally configured worlds or story worlds, which will have a spatiotemporal configuration, a cast of characters, other kinds of inhabitants, and you'll be mapping that out in more or less detail as you engage with the text in whatever medium you're engaging with it in. And again, you'll fill this out more or less fully to the extent required by your purpose in engaging with this narrative. And you can therefore frame provisional answers to questions like, how does the time frame of events in the world of the narrative relate to that of the narrational world-creating act? So is it retrospective narration? Is it prospective? Is it simultaneous narration as in a sports broadcast? How does that kind of shape your understanding of what's going on? Whose vantage point is guiding your attempt to reconstruct what happens? And again, how is the spatial setup configured, and how does that change as the narrative unfolds? Now, the second part of the study explores the converse question, how the process of building narrative worlds itself scaffolds efforts to make sense of experience. And I wanted to note right off the bat that I try to avoid making hyperextended claims about the power of narrative. You know, this is a temptation into which I think scholars of narrative too readily fall, right? Narrative is the be-all and end-all. As analysts like Galen Strawson want to insist, there are limitations to what narrative can do and its explanatory powers. And so, for example, in the book, I acknowledge the importance of pre- or non-conceptual modes of interpersonal attunement rooted in embodied experience. So I go to the developmental literature, for example, and look at Colwyn Trevarthen's ideas of primary intersubjectivity. Trevarthen argues that various young infants and their adult caregivers are able to have a kind of attunement which is not mentalizing, not theoretical, doesn't involve concepts, it involves rhythmic forms of coordinated interplay of bodies. And this would not be a narrative kind of sense-making, especially for the infant, because this kind of attunement would precede the having of narrative competence for the infant. So you know, that would put a limit on what sorts of things narrative can help us make sense of. More generally, I distinguish sense-making activities to which narrative centrally contributes from those that are more contingently associated with stories, things we could either use narrative for or not, and also sense-making activities that are inimical to being captured in narrative terms at all. So large aggregates of statistical data, for example, might resist being put into a narrative format. So again, trying to mark off limitations when it comes to the explanatory reach of narrative. That said, this part of the book does focus on topics like how narrative embedding allows knowledge of non-proximate events to be distributed in space and time. So when you have stories within stories within stories, it propagates knowledge about other places and times and situations and persons through this kind of narrative network. Look at stories of transformation, how they provide templates for intelligent activity. So stories about characters in flux can guide our own understanding of a world in flux. And also how storytelling constitutes a resource for folk psychology, the indigenous methods that we use to make sense of the conduct of self and other. In contexts in which persons' reasons for acting remain underspecified and potentially indeterminate, given the available pragmatic cues, stories do seem to provide a critical resource for making sense of what's going on. by enabling tellers to manipulate temporal relationships among events, vary perspectival stances, frame what happens in light of what might have happened or could possibly happen. Stories furnish a powerful resource for sense-making, allowing what goes on to be dovetailed with the intentions, desires, and experiences of persons, or more generally, intelligent agents. And in a more macro or super-personal way, we could talk about stories intervening in fields of discourses or ideological constellations, so political campaigns marshal different narratives about what's wrong with society and how it can be addressed. In a family dinnertime dispute, different versions of a set of events will be proposed and used to contest one another, and so forth. Now, when it comes to questions about how non-human experiences can be modeled in story worlds, this general approach, again, yields two main lines of inquiry. So we can follow this path of thinking about the worlding of the story or narrative as a target of interpretation, and we can ask questions like this: how do particular kinds of narrative designs figure the experiences of non-human characters in story worlds? In context of narrative interpretation, how do those designs evoke a wider ecology of projected experiences, human as well as non-human, when you have a world featuring intelligent agents that are both, that cross the species line? But we can also flip things around again and think about narrative as an instrument of mind and ask how narrative practices can be leveraged to make sense of non-human ways, animal ways of engaging with the world. How can stories be used to construct but also question boundaries between human and non-human strategies for negotiating surrounding environments? How do narratives allow us to make sense of those strategies? In recent work, I've been exploring the relevance of Jakob von Uxkull, the German-Estonian philosopher-biologist, Uxkull's concept of Umwelt for both of these lines of inquiry. And in the philosopher Evan Thompson's definition, an Umwelt is an animal's environment in the sense of its lived phenomenal world, the world as it presents itself to that animal thanks to its sensory motor repertoire. So animals have different physiological organismic structure. Some are bipedal, some are quadrupedal, some are mammals, some are not, different kinds of sensory acuities. And these differences, according to Uxkull, result in different phenomenal worlds, different phenomenological engagements with the world. And these are captured, according to Uxkull, with the concept of the Umwelt versus the environment that the animal inhabits in different ways because of its sensory motor repertoire. It would contrast with other animals. So this Umwelt concept can be leveraged against Heidegger's hierarchical model of species difference, for example, which harkens back to Aristotelian and post-Aristotelian accounts of the scale of nature. Here's one representation of this scale, where you've got divine beings at the top, inanimate objects at the bottom, humans toward the top, and non-human animals below them. So it's sort of a vertical map of ontological types and different degrees of moral worth are sort of associated. Probably in this scale, too, the male humans would be above female humans, right, in the, unfortunately, sexist versions of the scale. Now, likewise, Heidegger, who kind of lopped off the top half, held that non-human animals are poor in world, don't have rich worlds, in contrast with completely worldless inanimate objects, like stones at one end of the spectrum, and world-forming humans at the other end. But this Umwelt concept I've been mentioning explains intra as well as interspecies differences in terms of a dynamic unfolding of agent-environment interactions. So it allows us to shift from this kind of vertical hierarchical model to a flat horizontal model, where it all translates into agent-environment interactions, whatever type of being you're talking about. One in the same environment can present different affordances to different kinds of intelligent agents, depending on their sensory motor capacities in the history of their interactions with the environment in question. So this is an illustration from Uxkull's 1934 book, Foray into the Worlds of Animals and Humans. And on the left, you see the environment of the bee. And on the right, you see an attempt to model the bee's Umwelt. One premise of this, or assumption behind this model, is that because flowers constitute the bee's primary food source, they're the most salient aspect of the environment. They're what allow the bee to navigate this world. In the bee's Umwelt, it's the most salient feature. When you look to the left, flowers don't quite have that degree of saliency, And of course, one of Book School's points is that what we call the bee's environment is the human involved. That's our interpretation of where the bee is. It's our own involved. Conversely, we have a sense of foreground-background relationships that seem to be sort of lacking or fuzzed out in the right-hand diagram. The tree line versus the meadow doesn't seem to orient the bee's navigational strategies in the same way it does for us, perhaps, would be one assumption you could also draw from this model. So you're getting at interspecies variation in Umwelten. Now, there are also intraspecies differences. So here's a forester who comes up to an oak tree and measuring this knot in the tree, presumably how much wood it would take away if you harvested the tree. And then there's a child who's scared by this knot because it has the face of a monster, right? So two members of the same species, different experiential backgrounds, different histories of interaction with the environment, mean that the tree presents different kinds of possibilities, meaning possibilities for these two members of the same species. So the Umwelt concept then suggests that across species, and not only within same species, the basic structure of experience is the same, even if the qualitative details differ. And here we can bring in Andy Clark's concept of action loops. And this is the idea that because our human body is structured in a certain way, we undertake certain kinds of action in the environments we operate in. This produces certain kinds of perceptions or possibilities for perception that then enable other kinds of action. So you get this kind of looping structure that links body, mind, and world. And these loops mirror the dynamics that you see in this diagram, dynamics of perception and action, as presented by Warren, who shows here an agent taking an action in an environment that produces information that's recaptured by the agent and then used to guide successive negotiations of the environment. So you're not only shifting then from the vertical or hierarchical model associated with the scale of nature and with Heidegger's scheme, you're also moving from a Cartesian to a post or anti-Cartesian geography of the mental. Descartes, as you'll recall, separated sort of the material world from that is extended from unextended mental experiences, dichotomized those realms, but we're talking about agent-environment interactions as being the sort of wellspring of experience across species. So it's not separating mind and the world, it's the mind in conjunction with the world is what produces experience. And this also allows for narrative to be brought into the picture, because then you can start thinking about, do certain kinds of narratives capture these interactions in a more detailed way than other kinds of narratives? Do certain kinds of narrative techniques, depending on how they're used in a particular context, capture in a more fine-grained way these sorts of interactions than other techniques? And I tried to develop a taxonomy of animal comics based on this sort of model of agent environment and the degree to which interactions and the degree to which they're being imagined. So on the left end of the spectrum, you have animal allegory as exemplified by something like Spiegelman's mouse, where there's no real detailed engagement with the non-human worlds. You do have the predator-prey relationship being carried over from the cat-mice interactions into the representation of the German Nazis versus the Jews, but there's not really a detailed attempt to imagine what it would be like to be a cat or a mouse. On the far end of the spectrum on the right, you have the dystopian science fiction comic We Three, for example, which is about three house pets that are kidnapped by the military authorities and turned into bioworks, which are biologically and technologically enhanced weapons. And they are given the power of speech through a computerized speech synthesis system. And so the text tries to model how they're engaging with their environment. According to this kind of science fiction premise, you can sort of get into a construction of what their experiences might have been like. There are intermediary possibilities on this scale. So there's the anthropomorphic projection of Pride of Baghdad, a graphic novel that looks at the NATO-led bombing of Baghdad in 2003 and collateral damage on the zoo and a pride of lions. It tries to show the shock of the bombing on the lions, but in a very anthropomorphized way, relatively anthropomorphized way. The lions are drawn with human faces. They have human speech. Their family structures are like the structures of nuclear human families. If you move to the right, closer to Umwelt exploration, you get zoomorphic projection, where you're trying to model through a human character what it might be like to be a non-human being. So Animal Man is a comic series that goes back to the 60s. It's about this character who can acquire the capabilities of animals that he encounters in his environment. So at one point in one of the strips, he encounters an eel and it requires the ability to shock. So he stuns a criminal who's trying to escape with his shock power. So always handy to have those zoomorphic capabilities. Right? Now this diagram tries to suggest that in any given text, you can have more than one of these modes, but one mode will tend to be preponderant. So in Black Beauty, for example, Anna Sewell's 1877 Autobiography of a Horse, the preponderant mode there would be anthropomorphic projection, because this horse has human speech. Again, horse families look like human families. But the horse talks about the experience of being ridden by different kinds of riders, more or less cruel or sensitive. And so you're getting a degree of Umwelt exploration in that text as well. With Kafka's Metamorphosis, the story, at least initially, is preponderantly zoomorphic projection. Gregor Samsa is newly transformed into this insect-like being, and he still has strong memories of his human past, so you're sort of modeling the insect world through that filter of human. But as the story goes on, the human past starts to fade, and you sort of move in the direction of Umwelt exploration. Now, in the time remaining, I'm going to shift gears and suggest a revised version of Dennett's concept of heterophenomenology might provide us with other strategies for exploring narratives that engage with non-human experiences. Now, I'm going to come back to the Umwelt concept in a moment, but I'm kind of shifting emphases at least. So, part three, narratology and heterophenomenology. Now, as already mentioned, I'm using this term coined by Dennett, but I want to bring into the discussion a constellation of ideas that's broader, ideas developed by other theorists that are listed here. And I think collectively this work suggests that the idea of heterophenomenology needs to be kind of reshaped as compared with Dennett's original account of the concept. So we can start with Thomas Nagel's well-known 1974 article, What Is It Like to Be a Bat? And at the end of that article, Nagel concludes with some speculations about the possibility of what he calls an objective phenomenology. And he describes it as a theory of what it's like to be a particular kind of creature based on the creature's physiological structure, perceptual capabilities, behavioral dispositions, and so forth. As he puts it, though presumably it would not capture everything, objective phenomenology's goal would be to describe, at least in part, the subjective character of experiences in a form comprehensible to beings incapable of having those experiences. And of course, his example is the bat, which navigates through echolocation, has sonar capabilities that we humans don't. And so this would be a form, experiences that would be, he's saying, through objective phenomenology, comprehensible to us, even though we can't navigate through sonar ourselves. If you build up a detailed enough sort of profile of bat perception, you might kind of get a sense of it, at least in part. He develops these ideas in his 1986 book, The View from Nowhere. And in this study, he tries to make space for ineliminably subjective experiences within a broadly naturalistic and scientific worldview. So in that book, he argues against two forms of reductionism, reducing the subjective into the objective, which is basically eliminativism. And Dennett is an eliminativist, trying to eliminate irreducible subjective experiences into objective modes of description. Or you can go in the other direction and reduce the objective into the subjective, which, according to Nagel, leads to radical skepticism or even solipsism. So what he tries to do is start from the objective position and accommodate these irreducibly subjective domains rather than collapsing them into objective modes of description. So you get this statement early in the study. To accept the general idea of perspective without limiting it to the forms with which one is familiar, subjectively or otherwise, is the precondition of seeking ways to conceive of particular types of experience that do not depend on the ability to either have those experiences or to imagine them subjectively. So what he's saying here is that just being able to imagine the having of a perspective on the world of whatever character is necessary for us to be able to sort of work toward a model of what some form of perception, some having of a view that we ourselves can't have, might be like. So it should be possible to investigate in this way, he says, the quality structure of some sense we don't have by observing creatures who do have it, though the understanding that we reach is only partial. goes on to write, "We will not know exactly how scrambled eggs taste to a cockroach," speaking of Kafka, "even if we develop a detailed objective phenomenology of the cockroach's sense of taste. When it comes to values, goals, and forms of life, the gulf may be even more profound." So Denon is positing this radical inaccessibility, this gap between the human and the non-human. Non-human experiences remain fundamentally inaccessible at some level. Now Dennett, for his part, suggests by contrast that there's no fundamental distinction between the way heterophenomenology plays out in human non-human interactions and human human interactions. As he puts it in his book Consciousness Explained, and he kind of has taken Nagel's example of the bat, "We can rank order heterophenomenological narratives for realism, rejecting those that assert or presuppose discriminatory talents or reactive dispositions demonstrably not provided for in the ecology and neurophysiology of the bat. When we arrive at heterophenomenological narratives that no critic can find any positive grounds for rejecting, we should accept them as accurate accounts of what it is like to be the creature in question." So he's saying that through narratives that are grounded in what we know about bat physiology and bat perception, we can actually converge on non-human experiences and capture them in these realistic heterophenomenological narratives. Now, the thing about Denon, of course, is that he does not want to, unlike Nagel, leave room for ineliminately, if I can spit that word out, practice it a few times, but never fails, ineliminably subjective aspects of experience. He instead wants to dispute the utility and even the coherence of the concept of qualia, raw feels or phenomenal experiences associated with what it's like to be a particular kind of sentient creature. So the result is that for Dennett, non-human experiences are as accessible as human experiences, but at the cost, as I would see it, of a flattening out of qualitative differences in how differently structured beings might encounter the world. So to my mind, what's missing here is an attempt to register interspecies differences of the sort that Uxkull was trying to register and yet still keep in place this kind of common structure of Asian environment interactions as a frame for investigating those differences. Now, there are other grounds for objecting to Dennett's account. For example, Gallagher and Hutto, and these sources, by the way, are listed on the handout, so ready to look at the slide too closely. But they critique his account as over-intellectualizing and also misleadingly spectatorial. So if you see somebody with a hammer and there's a broken window, you can read from the pragmatic context what the likely intentions are. You don't have to kind of compute them in this sort of abstract theoretical way. And furthermore, our interactions aren't usually spectatorial in the way that this model of the intentional stance and heterophenomenology, as Dennett portrays it, might seem. We're typically engaged in interactions that are embodied and situated. And so we're not just looking on from afar, trying to figure out, trying to read what people's intentions are. It doesn't quite work like that, typically. Now, for their part, the philosophers Simon James and the psychologist Kenneth Shapiro talk about some of these same issues in connection with interactions between humans and non-humans, companion animals in particular. So they argue that when you interact with a dog, for example, again, it's not a theoretical attempt to sort out the dog's perceptions, read for intentions. There are rhythmic, coordinated forms of body interplay that allow you to read the dog's intentions and the dog to read your intentions that aren't as theoretical and mentalizing maybe as Dennett's account would suggest. So overall, I want to suggest the possibility of steering a course between the scilla of the radical inaccessibility of non-human minds, which I take to be Nagel's position, and the Charybdis of experiential homogenization or flattening, which I take to be sort of the pitfalls of Dennett's position. And this middle course would acknowledge those embodied modes of interaction and modes of attunement, which, again, aren't theoretical or spectatorial. And my thought is that pathways to a new heterophenomenology of this sort have been sketched out by the philosopher Alvin Noe, if I'm saying his last name correctly. But the question is how to link up developments in narrative scholarship with this revised approach in a manner that promotes transdisciplinarity. Again, not just the one-way borrowing from philosophy, but some sort of dialogue and exchange. Now, writing about companion animals like dogs, Noe notes that though it's possible to treat them as what he calls merely mechanistic merely mechanistic locus of conditioned response, when you enter into a relationship with a dog as a companion animal, you leave this standpoint of mechanism behind and instead view the dog as a thinking being. Something about our stance toward the dog, our way of engaging with it, our orientation to the dog in that kind of context that entails ascribing it mindedness. As he puts it in starker terms, there are two fundamentally different ways of thinking about things. From within one perspective, it's impossible to doubt the mind of others. From within the other, it's impossible to acknowledge it. So if you think about dogs, or humans for that matter, as sort of biophysical processes, the question of mind sort of goes away. But if you think about dogs or humans as agents in a life course with a life history, a certain set of experiences, then the question of mind naturally and inevitably asserts itself. And I made a similar argument in chapter 2 of the book, drawing on P.F. Strawson's ideas. So I argued that categorizing as a being, drawing directly from Strawson, as a person entails orienting to that being as a kind of entity to which it's possible to ascribe mental as well as physical traits. So once you categorize a being as a person versus an object, you assume that it's possible to self-ascribe mental traits, if it's you, or other ascribe heterophenomenologically traits to someone else, if it's another person. So this, what this suggests is that the concept of person is just part of the basic equipment we use for navigating the world, for making sense of experience, so that the problem of other minds doesn't involve epistemology, to borrow some thoughts of John Searle, another philosopher. Rather, it involves categorization. So when you categorize a being as a person, you assume that that person is minded, and it sort of controls how you orient yourself to that being. Now, similarly, Noe's account suggests that orienting to non-human others as beings caught up in a life history means relating to them at an ecological scale where heterophenomenology becomes not just possible, but obligatory. Mindedness is built into the concept of an animal viewed as or at the scale of a situated being living its life, just as it's built into the concept of humans viewed as or at the scale of persons. So we're talking about sort of a scale of encounter, a scale of description, and at a certain scale, mind inevitably arises as a way of engaging with another being. As Noe formulates it, to understand an animal, we have to take up a perspective on its life that's at once narrative and historical and also ecological. We need to pay attention to the story that really matters, the story of an organism's environment-bound life history. And once you see the organism as a unity, as more than just a process, you are in effect recognizing its agency, its possession of interests, needs, and point of view. So there are two ways, then, in which narrative scholarship can contribute in a transdisciplinary manner to the study of species of mind when it's set in this kind of context. On the one hand, we can extend research on narrative as a target of interpretation. We can explore what's at stake when you're trying to interpret a story that focuses more or less centrally on non-human lives. And I'm calling this avenue for inquiry the study of narrative and heterophenomenology. So the focus here is on investigating how textual designs enable interpreters to navigate story worlds in which the portrayal of non-human lives gives rise to attributions of mind. And try to sketch out an approach to narrative interpretation along these lines in this article from earlier this year about Virginia Woolf's semi-fictional biography of Elizabeth Barrett Browning's Cocker Spaniel Flush. Very interesting text, which raises really salient issues in this sort of context. On the other hand, we can go in the other direction and extend research on narrative as a resource for sense-making, studying how stories structure and enable encounters with non-human others as mindful beings in the first place, how narratives allow us to sort of arrive at a scale where those beings are not just sites of biophysical processes, but, again, agents in a life course, life history that we're trying to engage with in some fundamental way. And this avenue for inquiry is tantamount to studying narrative as heterophenomenology. So the focus here is on how in contexts where we don't have those sort of embodied routines that we use to ascribe intentions to companion animals, say, we could use narratives to configure circumstances and events into scenarios involving the experiences of non-human agents. So how do we use narratives to construct scenes from what non-human agents seem to be doing. How does that process work in the context of non-human agents versus human agents? And a range of case studies will be relevant for both of these strategies, for dovetailing narratology and heterophenomenology. We can look at fictional accounts of non-human lives. We can look at narratives that are concerned with non-human animals or environments in non-fictional discourse, non-fictional discourse of ethology or ecology or zoology. We can think about non-fictional stories concerning animals in nature writing, targeted at broader audiences versus particular scientific communities. We think about how narratives are used to recount or create trans-species entanglements, as you could put it, in various cultures and communities, pets within family contexts, or practices like animal-assisted therapy for persons with intellectual disabilities, for example. So just a couple last slides to mention that there's a research network in the planning stage that might allow for investigation of these sorts of issues. It's called the BioNarratives Network, grandiosely. The thought is it would allow us to connect three key terms: narrative, animal, and environment. The focus would be on bionarratives, which are defined as stories in which animal-to-animal or animal-to-environment interactions are of paramount concern. And so this kind of project would accommodate both stories that raise questions about the nature, status, and experiences of non-human animals, but it would also accommodate stories that foreground humans' own creatural profile, our profile as biological organisms whose life histories unfold within and because of specific ecological cultural niches. And I think that's going to do it for me. So I turn the floor over.
Thank you very much, David, for a very lucid presentation that interestingly dovetails with discussions we've been generally having about in our comparison criticism sessions about the limits of intelligibility and how and why you decide that you can't go any further. And at this point, the limit is the animal world, but we've been doing it a lot about cross cultures and between genres and whatever else. So kind of an interesting overlap between the conversations ongoing. So at this moment, just if you've got things you want clarified, then ask now, otherwise we'll go straight on to Emily's the first response member. So any questions, the points of clarification? Okay, in which case we'll go straight on to Emily's response.
Right, I want to start with the slide which I really agree with, which is number 9, which is about the necessity of getting together with people from, particularly in my view, the cognitive sciences, but I imagine the natural sciences in this particular area will have a lot to contribute as well. And I completely agree as well about the importance of getting beyond this unidirectional kind of interaction. That's something that I've been trying to do a bit myself recently, and it's jolly difficult, but I think it's important. I'll come back at the end of my comments to the notion of transdisciplinarity, because I'm wondering about the terminology there. My first sort of question, I suppose, relates to the two cross-cutting distinctions that you make. Well, particularly the first one, really. I wonder how separable the A and the B actually are. So it would seem to me that when you're looking at A, you would always be bringing in B and vice versa, that these things are always dovetailed in reality, and that investigating them as such might be a kind of useful way of proceeding rather than conceiving of them as oppositions. So I was wondering, I'm afraid I had time to read your whole book yet, and maybe you go into this there, but in your analytical practice, how much have you found that you end up, you know, trying to do one and actually looking at the other as well, so that CADA become actually CABDAB and so on. Because, yeah, I'd have thought when we're trying to make sense of our experience using narrative structures, that is pretty much the same as what we're doing when we're importing experience into narrative to make sense of it. Okay. Moving on a little bit. I had some thoughts about representation. My ears kind of always prick up when I hear the term representation these days, because I've got so deep into the whole second generation cognitive science, which is really in many areas rather anti-representationist. So I'm interested in your use of the term here. It seems to me there's kind of interesting slippage maybe between these two slides. So firstly, you're talking about this Cartesian opposition of inner and outer, and then in the next slide you go on to distinguish coarse-grained from fine-grained representation. But I guess I wonder whether are you talking about geography of the mental here, or are you talking about geography of representation of the mental? And do you see the two as pretty much equivalent? And also, is representation necessarily the most useful term here? I guess it does have it may have strongly cognitivist implications, which might not be particularly helpful in this sort of anti-Cartesian framework. I also wonder what criteria you are in practice using to distinguish between fine and coarse-grained. What aspects of experiences are you privileging? You say that you're interested in the interactions between agent and environment, but what happens if you get very fine-grained representation of what you might think of as classically Cartesian, like inner experiences? Where would you put that on the scale? So the next point was back again. Sorry, they're meant to be in kind of thematic order, but I was also very interested in relation to this concept of representation, in the notion of filling out or filling in, I suppose you could also say, of the various different textual dimensions. I've got interested in work, well, in relation to my work on Kafka. There is empirical work which suggests that different textual dimensions might be treated rather differently by readers. So in particular, the spatial dimension seems to be rather distinct from the others, in that we're much less inclined, at least according to one study, which, you know, there may be various flaws with it, but we may be less inclined to fill out the spatial dimensions unless it's absolutely necessary to our concerns, or it's made quite easy for us, i.e. the text does lots of it for us, as opposed to time, causality, personality kind of dimensions, where you might be inclined to do more automatically. And again, this would tie in with the anti-Cartesian stance. I guess a more traditional approach to thinking about reading or interpreting and representation making would be to say that we do need to build up a detailed internal model of everything that's going on in the text in order to be able to comprehend and respond to it. Whereas the more, if you take for example a more inactivist paradigm, you would perhaps reject that kind of assumption and say, you know, you do what is necessary for you in your moment to moment concerns, your inactive engagement with the environment of the text as it corresponds to a real environment. Is filling out the kind of potentially Cartesian thing that we need to interrogate from that perspective. 20. I'm also very interested in folk psychology, and I think it's exactly right that I think folk psychology depends to such a great extent on the resource of narrative that I'd be very interested to hear what more you have to say about that. You say at one point that when you're sort of delimiting yourself and saying, you know, we can't explore everything with the narrative model, you say that there's a sort of sensory motor level that underlies the narrative level. So I wonder I wonder how you understand the distinction between, if you like, the real psychology and the folk psychology. Are there kind of actual experiences which we might think of as profoundly non-narrative? So if you think of just the massive parallel processing in the brain, all the reasons for which we shouldn't posit a singular stream of consciousness, all that kind of thing, is that like the real psychology, and then we overlay that with a narrative kind of folk psychology? Or are the two always so, I mean, arguably we can't really access our own experience except through those narrative structures, so is it always just a mixture? I'm very interested in the whole animal side of things as well. The only thing which I've worked on which is connected up with this is Metamorphosis of Kafka. And I've kind of avoided the question really of what difference it makes that Gregor is transformed into vermin in that text. But it seems to me that a couple of the things that transformation is allowing Kafka to do are perhaps I was using the concept of emotion as appraisal, and specifically as action-bound appraisal, and I kept finding like brilliant examples in that text, far more than any of other texts. So it seems to me that maybe by being transformed into this animal form, that provides a good context for sort of stripping away some of the folk psychological layers that we tend to impose on experience, and maybe there's an evocation there of experience in a more, I feel like, a more raw form that the animal state makes accessible. It also raises an interesting question, like a lot of the unsettling stuff at the beginning of the story is to do with Gregor having explicit self-awareness, reflective self-awareness of stuff that ought to be just automatic, so like trying to get out of bed or something. So I wonder whether that ties in with the whole notion of the things that the gaps that we do have to fill in, you know, the things that become strange to us and require active inferencing. So just a couple more points. The way my brain works, I always turn to the question of empirical testing of all this kind of stuff. So I'm interested to know how much you think this is important, and also how you think it would be best done. For example, with the filling out of these different textual dimensions, would you expect this to be manifested in directly reportable experience that we might just probe people about directly, or would you expect it to be manifested rather in processing variables like reading times or eye movements? Are there also ways in which we might test that suggestion that I made at the beginning about the interconnectedness of storing the world and worlding the story, or would you need quite distinct experimental methodologies for the two things? I wonder whether you might get useful predictions from one for the other, so the ways in which we use narratives in everyday experience might help us make predictions about the dimensions that we then might fill in when we're reading narratives, but I don't know, that might just all get too complicated. And of course there's also the question of then devising methods that satisfy both the cognitive scientists and the humanities scholars, which is an eternal problem. So that leads me just to my final point, which is about the notion of trans and interdisciplinarity. I agree there's a big problem with how this kind of research tends to be done, and that we need to stop thinking like sciences are perfect and we can just take everything from them and it'll be fine. But I wonder whether, to me, it isn't the prefix that's the problem, it's just how people do it. So I don't know, I kind of think that interdisciplinary is okay as an umbrella for what we're doing, but that we need to just try and be more ambitious and do things better. But I guess you think that we need a new term so to get people out of the old habits. So I'd like to hear more about that as well. But thank you very much, that was a great talk.
Thank you. So thank you, Emmy. Lots of questions to help us focus our discussion. And I guess, James, do you want to do your bit? And then if David wants to have a kind of quick initial response, then that'd be great for our refreshments. First of all, any points of clarification from that Emily's response, unless filling your mind? Otherwise, let's have James.
Okay, as Ben indicated there, the white wine is getting warmer with each passing second, so I'll try and be a little bit succinct if I can in my comments. First thing I want to do then is applaud David. Thank you for an excellent project, an excellent book. Like Emily, I haven't had a chance to read it in its full depth, but I am familiar with vintage Herman, so I'm assuming it's going to be part of that same bouquet. The start in the same place that Emily did to talk about transdisciplinarity, I think it's really important and it's really interesting what you're proposing here, because it was a crucial issue perhaps in the current state of knowledge in the humanities and the social sciences. It's the gap between how we behave and how we represent ourselves as behaving. On the one hand, you've got behaviour, and on the other hand, you have narrative. And the two don't link together in any obvious, one is the one way, or in any kind of absolute, kind of simplistic kind of mapping. And I think what you're proposing here is a really good and a really kind of interesting way of bringing those two questions together. Because, I mean, psychologists have a habit of collapsing representations into behaviours. We represent certain things because we behave in certain ways, and therefore you explain representations. Whereas humanists pull the opposite trick, which is to dismiss behaviours and to dismiss biology and suggest that it's all culture. But of course, it's a reciprocal interaction between the two. And I guess what you're proposing here is an ideal way of bringing about those two levels together. So I want to kind of say that from the outset, as just that what struck me as being particularly fertile about the approach you're taking. In terms of the specific details, I don't have a whole lot I want to query you on, because I agree with so much of what you say. One thing perhaps that did strike me a little bit as you were giving the talk is that there was one word you didn't use, and that word is literature. And narrative and literature are not coterminous terms, clearly they're not, but at the same time, a lot of the exposure that we have to narrative comes from literary means. And it strikes me that we have narratives that we interpret, and we have narratives that we don't. And the narratives that we interpret tend to be literary narratives. So, every first year, English literature undergraduate course, they get Frankenstein, and they must go through the Marxist reading and the feminist reading and all the various readings. And then, once every 20 years, someone has a new reading and, everybody gets a party. So, in that sense, there are these texts which sponsor interpretation again and again and again. And there's narratives then that don't do that. And I'd be interested in kind of hearing where that distinction sits in the context of your model. Because you could take certain like inferentialist accounts of cognition, like take Dan Sperber and Deirdre Wilson's relevance theory. And they would say that, okay, we will interpret stuff that looks to us to be kind of challenging, because if it imposes a big cognitive load, therefore there's a good payoff at the end. So you read something like Finnegan's Wake, and you say, well, Joyce must have a really good reason for imposing this cognitive load, so therefore I will study it in depth. But that goes against a lot of the inactivist kind of background to a lot of what you're proposing, because you are drawing inferences when you do that. You do not kind of slide naturally or transparently into a narrative. Instead, you have a narrative that's almost opaque, and you're trying to penetrate into it. And I only raise that just to kind of to see what you might kind of respond to in that. The second issue I want to talk about then is to kind of collapse the second and third part of your talk together a little bit, to do with heterophenomenology and storing the world in the context of non-human subjectivities. And again, that struck me as a really, really productive line to take. First of all, there's the simple ethical reason why. I mean, I think it was Claude Lévi-Strauss made the point once about man's monumental stupidity in the face of himself, that everything he looks at, he just sees himself. And what animals then give us, non-human subjectivities give us, is that ability to step outside that kind of mirror of culture that we inhabit, in which everything is just a reflection of a reflection of a reflection. So I think it's really important that you're doing this now, and I think it's a really good move to be doing it at this particular point. And you can bring in a whole lot of stuff about environmentalism, but I hardly need to do that in this context. So yeah, and I think linking that activity to narrative is a really good idea as well, because what narrative gives us is this ability to exploit and to explore the counterfactual, to look at what is not the case, and to model what is not the case. And that, of course, is really useful when it comes to non-human subjectivities, because it's not so much what is not the case, but what we are not familiar with. And narrative gives us perhaps that counterfactual space and to explore that. But I would also suspect at the same time, and this is where the critique comes in, is that it might be a lot riskier an undertaking than it seems to be at first. Because on the one hand, it has a very, very dangerous risk of triviality in it, I would think, where you certainly are correct to pick out the idea that, you know, the umwelt that we have in common with other species does have structural features. So you will have agents, you know, who suffer a lack, who pursue a desire, who have barriers coming in the way, and all of these things most agentic creatures will have in common. And in that sense, yes, we do have grounds for access to that type of subjectivity. But at the same time, what you get is attenuated human beings if you can't get beyond that kind of correspondence. Because, I mean, you could have, take any kind of protagonist in fantastic literature who's non-human. You can have a ring in Tolkien, which has a will of its own, which has desires of its own, which wishes to do things. It's essentially still a human being, though. And I wonder to what extent we can legitimately say we're gaining access to non-human subjectivities if we're just looking at these morphodynamical schemes that perhaps we have in common with them. And the kind of second risk I would see is kind of the risk we have of smuggling in anthropomorphic assumptions unknown to ourselves. I read a lot of science fiction, for instance, and this is something that comes up again and again and again, where you have hard science fiction, where you have science fiction writers who try to take a genuinely alien subjectivity and represent it to us. And, you know, you can do that to greater or lesser degrees. And, I mean, there's a lot of contemporary writers, like Peter Watts, say, who tries to do that, and to my mind does it very well. But what always happens is that about 20 years later, some critic comes along, sees this, you know, indescribably remote alien and says, ah, it's communism. And you can always do that, where you kind of get the kind of concerns that were there at the time, and they become kind of transmuted almost kind of symbolically into the text. So I think we need to be really, really vigilant when we're kind of, first of all, producing narratives that reflect this alternative subjectivity, and second of all, perhaps analysing narratives. So I say yes, I think it's fantastic that you're doing it, but I would say that it's a hard thing to do. But, you know, the fascination of what's difficult, you know, makes it worth doing, I guess. So yeah, that's me.
So, David, do you want to say a couple of words in response, or would you like to wait until after people have got a glass in their hand? Or?
Well, should we take a poll?
Exactly. So how much concentration have we got? We've got a few more minutes concentration, or do we want to have a breather and let things sink in? Maybe we should just let things sink in. Is that all right with you? But you don't feel that you're kind of, you've been wrong, you've got to say now.
No, these are great comments.
Okay. Then you can kind of kick off and then, okay, so let's thank you very much to the three speakers again. Let's have a quick break.